Hey, it's Weasel. You're listening to Talk Today's Top and Trendy Technology Topics every Tuesday and Thursday with Adam Lepp, the computer guy, between 2:13 p.m. and 3 right here on The Talking Place, WWGH 107.1.
When you need to talk technology, no one gets you more gigs in your hard drive than Adam. It's time for Adam the Computer Guy with Adam Lepp.
And a very good Tuesday afternoon to you, my friends, fans, listeners, and anybody else out there. Thank you so much for tuning in. We are going to talk technology topics as the Weasel properly and so delightfully enunciated a few seconds ago. Some news about new operating systems from Apple, a new operating system for the Apple Watch. Sounds like an interesting thing to watch. YouTube and their policies on harassment and hate speech, been getting a lot of press coverage about that. We're going to discuss it in detail and hear some perspectives on all sides. Invite you, of course, to form your own opinion. Plus, how much money did Google make last year as a news outlet of sorts? Few billion buckaroos, and some people are saying it's actually more. So we will discuss that and much more. Here on the Adam the Computer Guy radio program on The Talking Place, WWGH Radio. I want to let you know we have excellent programming for you pretty much every day. Later today, we have the Pastor's Spot with Pastor Steve Whitaker and, of course, Linda Sims with her program that she has on Monday and Tuesday in the afternoon. Don't want to miss that. Great conversation with Terry and Scott about Boys to Men and the Gin Blossoms and all kinds of other stuff. Hopefully you had a chance to catch that before I went on the air. But if you ever miss a program, that's okay. Go to our website, WWGH1071.com, and in the show archives, you can listen on demand. That's how we do stuff here at The Talking Place. You can listen live, listen at your leisure. Of course, most importantly, share this station and its wonderful attributes with your friends, family, neighbors, and everybody else. And much more great programming on the way. Lulu from Hee Haw will be live in the studio, live at Perkins in Marion in several days. That should be an exciting event. Of course, we just finished our fifth anniversary extravaganza. And this Saturday morning and every Saturday morning, 7 to 10 a.m., make the coffee, set the alarm clock, because it is the Weasel Show with Weasel Boy Chad Harrison and his very lovely wife, Heather Marie Harrison, as they make fun of anything, anybody, including themselves, as well as do silly stunts, talk about life, almost like on Seinfeld, just talk about anything and don't take anything or themselves too seriously, so it makes for a humorous and oftentimes educational and occasionally controversial conversation. They invite calls from listeners like yourself and via Facebook messages, as they usually broadcast a live video on Facebook, and they will be giving away tickets to see Lance Bass in Pickerington. Don't want to miss that. Again, this and every Saturday morning, 7 to 10, here on The Talking Place. What a pleasure to be among all the fine radio personnel at this station. However, it is now time. Yes, drum roll, please. Get on, put on the Scotch tape on your eyeglasses if they are falling apart. Don a pocket protector. Acquire all the available programs of Star Trek and Battlestar Galactica. Time to get geeky. Talk tech topics on the place for talk, WWGH Radio. So what happened last year, 2018? A study estimates that Google got $4.7 billion from news content. And that study has drawn widespread criticism. Is it fake news, real news, or maybe something in between, like often seems to be the case? According to the News Media Alliance, it's actually higher. The News Industry Trade Group, News Media Alliance, released the study recently, and they said it's because the estimate doesn't take into account Google's advertising revenue from publishers and data collected from news content. The actual value of news content to Google is difficult to quantify because of the ways that it uses news to drive traffic, as well as develop its products and entrench its dominant position. According to the study, which strategy and economics consulting firm Keystone Strategy carried out for the News Media Alliance. In addition to using news content for product development, like training its artificial intelligence services, Google tailors its products, ramps up its use of news to keep users in the Google ecosystem, according to the study. The CEO of the News Media Alliance, David Chavern, said news publishers need to continue to invest in quality journalism, and they can't do that if the platforms take what they want without paying for it. He said information wants to be free, but reporters need to be paid. That's always good to get paid, isn't it? One of the key assumptions underlying the $4.7 billion number that news is worth $100 million to Google is flawed, according to critics. The study relies on weak back-of-the-envelope calculations, said Russell Newman, an assistant professor in the Liberal Arts and Interdisciplinary Studies Department at Emerson College in Boston. He said, "In my world, this wouldn't have stood up to peer review by any stretch. It's a bit ridiculous." Dan Kennedy, professor at the School of Journalism at the Northeastern University, said, "The value of news to Google is hard to quantify. I thought it was a little dubious based on the fact that they tried to come up with an exact figure, when an exact figure isn't something that you can calculate." The study found that both Facebook and Google are dependent on news content. He said, "My sense is that Google is dependent on news content to some extent, but Facebook is not. So lumping them together seemed like a questionable proposition." Now, in its defense, Google told The Guardian that it collaborates with and supports news publishers worldwide, and that its news and search features have delivered more than 10 billion clicks to publishers' sites, hence driving subscriptions and ad revenue. Google says the study is based on back-of-the-envelope calculations and is inaccurate. The NMA said Google has stated that there are back-of-the-envelope computations without offering a view into what's actually in the envelope. "The news industry has been asking for these numbers for years. It's incumbent upon Google to be transparent about their income derived from news." So, yeah, how much does Google make from news, being a news outlet of sorts? Well, over $4 billion, but people are saying that that's actually low. It's more than that. In fact, we call upon Google to share this data on their quarterly reports and discuss this on their earnings calls. Doing so would be in the interest of ensuring vibrant democracies and free press around the world. Critics also have lambasted a New York Times report on its findings, published the day before this Google study was released. Dan Gilmore is a professor at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication at Arizona State. "No kidding," tweeted back Aaron Pilhofer, chair of journalism innovation at Temple in Philadelphia. That's where my mom went and where Bill Cosby went. So anybody at Temple is probably a very smart cookie. And she was also a journalism major, by the way, although, of course, it was quite a long time ago. Professor Newman said a study appeared and they took it at face value. It was pretty weak reporting. The Times is not making any apologies for the story. The Times said it's fair and accurate. It made clear that this $4.7 billion, again, what Google supposedly made from its news ventures last year, is the result of a study by News Media Alliance, a nonprofit organization. And this is according to the New York Times. "We go on to call the $4.7 billion figure an estimate and made sure to explain to our readers how this group came up with that number. We also disclose early and explicitly the relationship between the Times and the Alliance." The release of the study was a political move by the National Media Alliance, the NMA, which was scheduled to testify recently on a bill before Congress to give news publishers a 4-year antitrust exemption, during which they could collectively bargain with the owners of online platforms over revenue splitting. And that comes from John Carroll, a media analyst in Boston. He said this estimate that the newspaper association came up with is a tool for them to convince the government that newspapers need some kind of relief, that they've been put at a significant financial disadvantage because of Google. The question is whether the newspaper industry should get the government to do anything at all. There's a school of thought that says journalists do not want to let the government into their house for any reason, because however it might start out, once the government is inside your house, eventually they are going to kick off their shoes, make a bologna sandwich, and occupy your living room couch. That's the last thing journalists need. Whether Google is at fault for the news industry's woes is questionable. You can argue that the Newspaper Association has made its bed at this point by giving content away for free and training people to think that digital content should be free, and by doing a bad job of convincing people that what newspapers produce is unique enough and valuable enough that they should pay for it. So Google, making a few billion dollars from being a news outlet of sorts, and not surprisingly, a little bit of controversy. But what would life in the IT world be without a little bit of controversy? Adam Lepp here, the computer guy, with my twice-weekly radio program called the Adam the Computer Guy Show, here on The Talking Place, WWGH Radio. What else is going on in the world of technology? Well, YouTube recently demonetized, that's a good word, demonetized the account of right-wing commentator Steven Crowder, following widespread indignation over its initial response to his attacks on Vox host Carlos Maza. So why did that happen? Well, for years, Crowder has attacked Maza, host of Vox's Strike Through series. Crowder's homophobic and racist comments often spurred mass social media attacks and other abuse against Maza. Maza repeatedly flagged Crowder's vitriolic YouTube videos, but his reports apparently went unheeded until last month, May, when he posted a tweet that went viral. YouTube responded with a tweet stating that an in-depth review of Crowder's flagged videos found language, quote, that was clearly hurtful. But it went on to say that, quote, the videos, as posted, don't violate our policies. As an open platform, YouTube said it's crucial for us to allow everyone to express their opinions within the scope of our policies. Opinions can be deeply offensive, but if they don't violate our policies, they'll remain on our site. YouTube does not endorse or support the viewpoints expressed in videos on its platform. It did, however, offer to explain its decision on background to The Verge, which is owned by Vox Media, but chief editor Nilay Patel turned down the offer because YouTube would not go on the record. Dan Goldstein, a president of Page One Solutions, said, I believe that YouTube missed an opportunity here to be more transparent in the way it interprets and enforces its stated policies. Like other social media platforms, YouTube has an obligation to clearly state its policies on harassment and privacy. Once stated, it must enforce them or users won't respect the boundaries. YouTube did shut the door on further action, tweeting, there are other aspects of the channel that we're still evaluating. We'll be in touch with any further updates. So, what exactly is involved with YouTube's harassment and cyberbullying policy? It bans content or behavior intended to maliciously harass, threaten, or bully others. For example, revealing somebody's personal information, although posting widely available public info, like a public official's office phone number, is okay. Also, content deliberately posted to humiliate someone, content that makes hurtful and negative personal comments or videos about another person, content that incites others to harass or threaten individuals on or off YouTube, sexualizing or degrading an individual who is engaged or present in an otherwise non-sexual context. So those things, quite understandably, are a no-no for YouTube. YouTube will remove content promoting violence or hatred against individuals or groups based on various attributes, including ethnicity, gender identity, nationality, race, and sexual orientation. Now, Crowder's attacks on Mazza appear to have breached both policies. Michael Jude, some we quote him often, he's from Straightcast, Frost and Sullivan, a very smart dude, Michael Jude, he said, however, what one person considers hurtful, another might think of as spirited debate. And that's true. There are not all black and white issues. A lot of questionable decisions about, is it harassment? Is it an opinion? Is it hate speech? Depends how you look at it, although many times it is obvious. Michael Jude said YouTube should define a standard that satisfies everybody, but I don't think that's possible given the subjective nature of what they're attempting to control. And not, again, that's understandable. How you look at it, who said it, history of what this person has said, it's not quite as simple as you might think. Melissa Dunphy, a YouTube user who goes by the handle Mormolike, M-O-R-M-O-L-Y-K-E, said, your policies are, not a word I can say on the radio, but it starts with a B and has eight letters. Calling someone Lispy Sprite is harassment, tweeted Julian Nader Saliani, saying you're being given a free pass as a crappy writer because you're gay is harassment. Calling someone Little Queer is harassment. Calling someone Mr. Gay Vox is harassment. And that's from Twitter user Julian Nader Saliani, who goes by the handle Saliani J. Media stories about YouTube's initial response were overwhelmingly negative. Crowder posted what he called an apology on YouTube, but he used the video to level a broad round of insults against numerous targets, couched in disingenuous, poker-faced sarcasm. YouTube CEO Susan Wojcicki said earlier this year, YouTube updated its policies to a simpler and more transparent system because of complaints from creators that the community guidelines strike system felt inconsistent and confusing. Every creator would get a one-time warning, providing the opportunity to learn about YouTube's policies before being penalized. YouTube tweeted that it had suspended the monetization of Crowder's channel because a pattern of egregious actions has harmed the broader community and is against our YouTube partner program policies. And Michael Jude, again, an expert from Straightcast, Frost and Sullivan, said demonetizing Crowder's channel was a subjective call, likely driven by an assessment of the political situation. Many conservative organizations regard YouTube as being liberal and intolerant of conservative views. Perhaps this was a way for YouTube to demonstrate that it tolerates both sides. Users and advertisers who object to YouTube's approach can simply vote with their feet. Ultimately, these companies will only change if failure to change will negatively impact their finances. Yes, vote with your feet and your mouth and your keyboard. Again, take your business, take your views elsewhere. It's part of the free enterprise that the internet is so much founded on, and I would tend to agree. And sometimes what's hate speech, what is a strong opinion, isn't quite so simple, but as some of those users mentioned, it can be obvious. What I say, form your own opinion. Much more fun that way, and certainly you learn something and stimulate conversation for anything that may happen in the future. Yeah, Adam Lepp here, talking about the future, the past, and almost anything else on the Adam the Computer Guy radio program, a twice-weekly feature here on The Talking Place, WWGH Radio. What else is going on in the world of technology? So much to talk about. So many things occurring in our fine earth that we call home. Apple has dangled the next versions of iOS, macOS, and watchOS before developers' eyes at a recent worldwide developers conference in San Jose. We've talked about some updates for Apple recently, but I got some new news for you. In this new round of operating system upgrades, Apple seems focused on improvements. Ross Rubin from Reticle Research in New York City said, "They are polishing a number of aspects of the operating systems. They're breaking out the iPad OS into its own code base and continuing a path toward autonomy for Watch OS." Tuong Nguyen from Gartner, Stamford, Connecticut, a research and advisory company, said, "More than anything else, Apple has been about the user experience. A strong part of that was technological innovation. This year it was about improvements and adopted features like swipe, dark mode, and desktop browsing that have existed on other platforms for quite some time. A lot of iOS 13 is just playing catch up with Android, which was way ahead of Apple in certain areas," according to Bob O'Donnell from Technalysis Research, a technology market research and consulting firm in Foster City, California. He said it was great to see the improvements in Maps, but that was really playing catch-up. Among the changes coming to the next version of Apple's iOS mobile operating system is an improved Maps app. It has broader road coverage, better pedestrian data, more precise addresses, and more detailed land cover, as well as a new look-around feature that allows you to experience a location at street level. Charles King from Pundit in California, a technology consultant, we also quote him often, said, "For years, Apple Maps has lagged significantly behind Google Maps in terms of features, as well as functions and local details. The new enhancements discussed at the developers' conference should be a welcome relief to both Apple developers and customers. Apple has added a dark mode in iOS 13 also. It's especially useful in low-light conditions. What's more, Apple has opened it up to developers so they can use it in other apps, in their own apps. Embracing dark mode across its platforms could be an indicator of where Apple is headed with its display technology," according to Wayne Lam from IHS Market, a research analysis and advisory firm in London, and they analyze mobile devices and networks, so they should know what they're talking about. He said if they're going to go with dark mode, the best type of display is going to be an OLED display. So it appears that their 2019 product line will be all OLED. But of course, we will find out. Apple also beefed up photo apps in the new operating system. The photo software uses an onboard machine learning to curate a photo collection, making it easier to relive moments by day, month, or year. Photo editing tools are more accessible, and they incorporate sliders for application of effects. In addition, users can apply editing effects to video. Portrait mode is accessible directly in the camera app, New features let you move your light source in and out on a subject to change the ambiance of a shot. There's also a high-key mono effect for creating distinctive monochromatic portraits. iOS 13 will come with a new way to sign on to apps and websites. Instead of using a social ID from Facebook or Google, you can use your Apple credentials to sign in. The new offering, called Sign In with Apple, lets you use a biometric face or fingerprint to log in to an app or site. The feature has two-factor authentication built in for an additional layer of security. Apple has announced a new iOS-based operating system for the iPad. Charles King said the new iPad operating system and related features will be a boon to iPad users, especially those who depend on the device for productivity applications. The new features and functions will also allow the iPad to compete more effectively against commercial laptops, a market that Apple desperately needs to crack. Wayne Lamb from IHS Markit said for years the iPad has been emulating the user interaction of the iPhone, but with features like multi-windowing and the use of keyboards and mice, the platform is becoming more sophisticated. Most surprising of all was a feature buried in the accessibility settings: support for wired or Bluetooth mouse devices. So talking about some improvements in the new Mac operating systems. What wasn't mentioned on stage, again, at a developers conference recently, where Apple debuted their upcoming new and exciting operating systems. Apple and supporters have reportedly tried to downplay the importance of including support for Bluetooth and wired mice and trackballs and similar pointing devices. But taken in concert with these other new iPad operating system features, it seems obvious that Apple is finally coming to grips with the iPad's greatest shortcomings, all related to its lack of common, valuable functions that PC owners enjoy every day. So making an iPad function in ways that are like an Android tablet, which I think is an excellent idea. And iPad users can look forward to that with the new version of the iPad operating system. Also, Apple departed from previous naming conventions with the next release of the Mac OS for the regular Mac desktop computers. It's called Catalina. It'll be able to run iOS apps for like an iPhone. You can run those on a desktop. And that's thanks to Project Catalyst, formerly known as Marzipan. The codenamed Marzipan tool makes it easier to port iOS apps onto the Mac, which allows developers to sell on iOS and Mac app stores without reconfiguring their apps. It's according to an analyst, Gene Munster. Jack Gold, an IT advisor in Northborough, Massachusetts, said, "Catalyst is pretty cool. It's going to get a lot of interest because there's a lot of iOS apps out there that people want to run on other devices. With Catalina, Apple is retiring iTunes and replacing it with three new apps for music, podcasts, and TV shows and movies. Apple has also added a feature called Sidecar that lets you use an iPad as a second display or a drawing tablet." Apple also showed the developers conference crowd a new voice control app for Catalina that lets users who are unable to operate a computer with traditional devices to control it with their voice. Through a system of labels and grids, users can interact with virtually any app using comprehensive navigation tools. Pretty cool. Just talk to your computer. It goes beyond the voice recognition that I use on my phone. Definitely a important tool for those who might have a handicap that wouldn't let them type. I think that's a good thing to do. With the next version of Watch OS, an operating system for the Apple Watches, Apple Watch will get its own app store, and users will be able to download apps without the assistance of the iPhone. The ability to get apps separately is a big deal. It's the first sign of making the watch independent completely, and potentially have it work with other platforms. A separate watch operating system is thought to be good for the watch's ecosystem also. The use cases for the watch have long been debated, due in part to consumers not being aware of the available watch OS apps. We believe an app store on the watch will increase consumer awareness. Increasing awareness will drive developers to create more and useful watch-based apps, and the watch should become more useful over time. This should have the small effect of increasing demand for Apple Watch, which now accounts for about 5% of Apple's revenue. Apple has announced some new apps for the watch operating system, including cycle tracking, which allows women to log important information about their menstrual cycles, and Noise, an app that tracks sound levels that could be damaging to a user's hearing. So exciting stuff coming with the new versions of the Apple operating systems. And we cover that stuff here on The Talking Place, right here on the Adam the Computer Guy radio program, WWGH Radio. Account hijacking has become a major problem at Instagram. Instagram is essentially a division of Facebook, so they've decided to do something about it. They've begun testing a simpler method for users to reclaim their compromised accounts. It allows users to ask for a 6-digit code to be sent to the email address or phone number originally used to open the account. And that's if you're locked out of an account due to a hacker. Instagram has also taken steps to address the issue of username theft. After hijacking an account and changing its settings to lock out its owner, some hackers will try to sell its name. Short, unique usernames can sell for as much as $5,000. To curb that practice, Instagram will bar the transfer of a username for an unspecified time after changes are made to an account. It's not known when the 6-digit reset feature will be available throughout Instagram, but the lockdown edition already is available to Android and Apple users. Selling usernames is not the only way criminals can turn hijacked Instagram accounts into cash. They can monetize the credentials for the account by selling them to other hackers. For example, according to Rick McElroy, head of security strategy at Carbon Black, an endpoint security company in Massachusetts. He said they can also extort the owner into paying to release the account. In addition, they can blackmail the affected person based on material found in the account and phish other people connected to the account. That is, send out those fake emails. Now, attacks on Instagram accounts are not always launched by strangers. Jonathan Tanner from Barracuda Networks in Campbell, California, said targeted attacks are also common among people the attacker knows. In those cases, the motivation may be information. For example, is my boyfriend or girlfriend cheating on me? Or revenge. My girlfriend or boyfriend cheated on me, so I'm going to hijack his or her account and embarrass the person. Well, karma, rearing its ugly head. Munir Hahad from Juniper Networks, a security and performance company in California, said political motives also spur some account hijacking, especially with influences in countries where freedom of speech is not respected. Accounts can be taken over, sometimes illegally, by force, to sway the message just enough to change the narrative about an upcoming election or a public protest. John Shear from Sophos, a network security and threat management company in the UK, said Much of this problem stems from the implicit trust we place on posts coming from people we know. You shouldn't trust everything you see on social media. Although Instagram's action makes it easier to recover a compromised account, its impact on hijacking remains to be seen. These measures only make it somewhat less stressful to recover a hijacked account and will not do much to curb the hijacking attempts. If the attacker is sophisticated enough and has compromised an original email address used to create the Instagram account, then it may still be difficult to regain control of the account, even with new measures in place. Some criminals may be dissuaded from hijacking Instagram accounts, but the practice will continue. Criminals don't need much time to benefit from an account hijack. If their purpose is simply to spread malicious or fraudulent links, the compromise of a prominent celebrity's account is all it would take. Thousands of followers would likely see the link and click on it before the compromise was noticed. Will LaSala from OneSpan, an authentication and fraud analysis company in Chicago, said, "Instagram's account recovery solution is just a short-term fix. Stronger solutions are needed to address future attacks. Stronger solutions force the application to properly identify the risk associated with the request and then to enforce stronger methods of authentication when a high risk is detected. This type of intelligent authentication can help users by ensuring only the strongest authentication methods are used by the user and only when the user needs them the most." Byron Rashid from Centripetal Networks, a network security company in Herndon, Virginia, said, "Account hijacking has been going on for more than a decade. At first, it was a challenge by script kiddies, but then it became a business when threat actors discovered how valuable these accounts can be. Many accounts can have valuable personal identifying information that can be sold and traded in the underground economy to fully monetize the exfiltrated accounts. Account hijacking is widespread online, according to the experts. It will continue to be a growing area of concern for highly visible individuals. Criminals either want money to release the accounts or blackmail the user about pictures and other sensitive content found in cloud storage. Account hijacking across all sites is quite rampant. Hijacking is fueled by the massive amount of information stolen in data breaches. There are tools hijackers can use that incorporate breach data to facilitate their hijacking activities. Those products make a configuration file for a site that specifies how the login process works, as well as what list of email and password combinations to try, and includes a list of proxy IPs to use so that IP-based protections won't be as effective." Rami Asad from Distill Networks, a website security firm in the Washington, D.C. area, said, "Password theft is framed as a consumer problem, but it can have a significant impact on a business also. Password dumps create a ripple effect as organizations spend precious time and resources on damage control. There's a massive spike in failed logins. Then the access into someone else's account before the hacker changes the password. Then the account lockout for the real user. Then the customer service calls to regain access to their account. All because a username and password was stolen from a different website. So if you're an Instagram user, watch out. There are hackers that want to get your information. But like with anything in security, using common sense is 95% of the solution. If there's ever a question about your security for your logins, for your computer, your social media, definitely contact your friendly neighborhood computer tech person. I am at AdamTheComputerGuy.com. As I do mention on this show from time to time, I am a Sprint cell phone, smartphone, stupid phone user and have been for a about 21 years, I believe. So the thought that they will be merging with T-Mobile is certainly of interest to me, as well as other Sprint customers. They previously had acquired Nextel, but you know, T-Mobile and Sprint, neck and neck competitors, and they may become one company. The merger would involve $26 billion. It's a lot of money. It appears to be on again, leaving the combined company poised to become the second largest wireless provider in the country. The United States Department of Justice is prepared to approve the deal within days, according to CNN Business. How's that for up-to-the-minute news? Pending all parties agree on concessions, the Justice Department will approve the deal, possibly by the end of this week. That is June 22nd of 2019, or maybe the beginning of next week, according to a person familiar with the matter. The concessions would likely include the sale of Boost Mobile, which is Sprint's discount pay-as-you-go wireless subsidiary. Now, negotiations are still ongoing, and the Department of Justice is prepared to litigate if the negotiations fall through. The Justice Department's blessing is a step forward for T-Mobile and Sprint as they seek to join forces against the big ones, Verizon, AT&T. The deal will not yet be final once the Justice Department approves it. It still awaits clearance by the FCC and a group of state attorneys general. Now, last week, New York and California's state attorneys general filed a lawsuit looking to block the proposed merger, along with seven other states and the District of Columbia. They said the merger would lead to less competition and better returns for network operators. The states may have to agree to the company's concessions before they drop the suit. Last month, FCC Chairman Ajit Pai recommended that the FCC bless the deal after Sprint and T-Mobile made some revisions to the structure of the planned merger. To receive Pai's blessing, the companies agreed to certain coverage commitments, including 100 megabit per second download speeds, equivalent to a fast broadband at your house, accessible to two-thirds of Americans within 3 years of the deal's closing. They pledged to build a 5G network within 6 years following the merger. That network will, they promised, also include coverage for some rural Americans. And they also said that the new company will offer an in-home broadband product. As mentioned, Sprint agreed to divest Boost Mobile, and the companies agreed to pay the FCC up to $2.4 billion in fines if they violate the agreement. So some interesting events that may be coming in the mobile industry. T-Mobile, which I used to have maybe 25 years ago, and Sprint, which I've had for 21 years, becoming one company, and that might take place before the end of the week. We will keep up to date on this story, as it certainly is a biggie. Adam Lepp here, the computer guy, on The Talking Place, WWGH Radio. And it's about a minute away from closing time on the Adam the Computer Guy radio program. Hopefully I've educated, entertained, and maybe even invited controversy. That T-Mobile and Sprint merger, that just literally came across my desk earlier this afternoon. It is up-to-the-minute news, and it's a biggie. I may find my cell phone company, my smartphone, my not-so-smartphone company, Sprint, becoming something else, maybe even before we talk again next Thursday. Want to remind you, don't touch that dial. We have Linda Sims as well as Pastor Steve Whitaker with their programs coming up later today. Definitely good radio for your ears, brain cells, and other parts of your body. We do that here at The Talking Place. Stimulating conversation, sometimes a little controversy, always a laugh or two, and just like on this show, a surprise at least twice an hour. Not a bad day outside, but I'm sure it will rain later. We've had some record-breaking rain amounts in 2019, and of course, our resident weather forecaster, Zach, will be along a little later in the 3 p.m. top of the hour features to tell you all about what is coming up in the Mother Nature Department. If you'd like to communicate with me and you're not already a Facebook friend, please request my friendship. I would love to have you. And my list of people that I speak with regularly, look up Adam the Computer Guy or Adam Lepp in Ohio. And of course, you're always welcome to send me an email on our famous private email server. The address is adam@wwgh1071.com.